All right, so questions. You guys have any questions about stuff we've been talking about in the last few months, or really anything that might be on your heart and mind? This is our time to kind of close out the year by asking those. Yes, Isaac.
I have a question. As a pastor, when do you switch gears from, you know, what's your deciding factor of switching gears from exposition to a huge cultural event or major thing that sort of rattled the nation or the culture or even the local?
Well, I think it's very, the bar is very high for me because, first of all, I think that the thing that rattles, or the thing that the culture is going on in the culture is best addressed by a strong, healthy church, and a strong, healthy church is best produced by sequential Bible exposition. Contextual, you could even say it that way, contextual Bible exposition. So I'm very hesitant to do that. But if I feel that there is extensive confusion about something, ongoing confusion that, and I'm not going to have a chance in the near future in, you know, maybe the next five chapters of whatever I'm preaching, if I'm not going to have a chance to address that looking ahead in the text that I'm in naturally, then there might merit pulling out and doing something. So, you know, through the years, I can't think of very many times that I have done that. Obviously, this past year, I did the cultural creeds, which was kind of born out of conversations I was having with parents who were confused about how to talk to their kids about some of these issues. And I knew that in the preaching of Matthew, I wasn't necessarily going to be covering that anytime soon. Honestly, I can't remember anything before that other than the Obergefell decision in 2015. I preached a message right after that because I had a sin, and I preached the week it was made in June. It wasn't like any delay because I had a sense that that was a watershed moment for our culture, and wanted to make sure that the church was thinking rightly about that. You know, and then the other times have been like, you know, when we're doing starting a building program or something like that. But I just so deeply believe that the preaching of God's word in context, in the sequential context, is so valuable, so much more important than any kind of topical thing that might be hitting the headlines. That I'm very reticent to pull away from it. And I think about it historically, because if you go back just a couple hundred years, maybe even 150 years, when people weren't paying attention to national news like they do today, that they were just worried about how to, you know, make it through another day at work, how to love their family and trust the Lord for, you know, whatever, you know, paying the bills or putting food on the table, as the politicians would say, kitchen table issues. That was what consumed preaching. And I still feel like that. I mean, I feel like I'm not going to allow some national media and whatever they're interested in to drive what we're interested in as a church. You know, think about these protests going on campuses, which are essentially, if you added all of these boneheaded students together across all these campuses, you'd struggle to probably find 1,000 people. I mean, it's 25 people over here and 50 people over here. I'm not going to let 1,000 people out of 350 million in America dictate what we're going to do in a church. But it's consuming the media. I mean, if you look at them, that's like that's like every other story is something to do with that. So that's the illustrative, I think, of why you don't chase after the headlines. You just keep going back to what God has determined through the flow of His Scripture is the balance of truth that we need. And by doing sequential Bible exposition, that's what you get. You get the balance that God wanted. If He wanted us to hear 98 out of 100 messages on eschatology, then 98 of 100 out of 100 chapters would be eschatology. If you wanted us to hear 98 out of 100 messages on the family, then he would have inspired 98 out of 100 chapters on the family. But by preaching sequentially through books, then we wind up getting the balance of what he wants us to hear. So that's how I basically work through that. It's rarely, really rare that I would do anything but sequential exposition. Good question, though. Other questions? Yes, Rick.
Yes, as a pastor, specifically at Faith Community Church, what is one of your greatest concerns about the growth of the church, local church?
Concerns that we're growing too much, or?
Concerns about just where we need to be as a church.
Oh, I see. Yeah, you're talking about, you know, concerning spiritual growth, what's on my heart and mind. You know, I think there are probably two things. There's, on one hand, I'm always concerned that we lose our first love. I think that's always kind of in the back of my mind. And when I say that, I think it's manifested. It would be manifested in my mind if we, first of all, lose an interest in Christ's word. That's one of the things that you sometimes see from churches. They just get weary of the word. You know, they start wanting to replace the word with other things. It may not happen on Sunday morning right away, although I've seen that. I remember going to a pastor's meeting early on. I mean, this is my first year of ministry. I went to this little pastor's fellowship in the town, and they had a balloon artist, like the kind of thing that you would see at a carnival. And his long, skinny balloons tied into animals. And the whole hour, the guy was teaching us how to tie balloons into things. And then at the end of the hour, he had the audacity to suggest that we actually set aside our sermon this coming week and do this. I was a young guy, but I was so incredibly offended. I never went back to that group again, no matter what they offered. That's an extreme case. But even at the sort of localized level, you'll have people at the community group, sometimes at the Sunday school hour, they'll want to start replacing the word with something else. You know, we have so much Bible study, we have so much teaching, you know, too much teaching, let's do something else. So that's, to me, one evidence of a church beginning to lose its first love. I think the other is the lack of patience and love towards one another, because that is directly born out of a person's reflection on God's grace in their life. So when we're not forgiving towards others or patient towards others, as Paul says in Ephesians, bearing with one another, being patient with one another as Christ has been with you, when we're no longer doing that with one another, it's a reflection of the fact that we're not meditating on Christ's love toward us, and that's a sign that you're losing your first love. So that's one category for me as a pastor, that we as a church don't do that. And I think there's a tendency, especially for churches like ours, who are very focused on having doctrinal fidelity and precision, I think there's a tendency, there's always a threat that we could do something like that. The other thing that I'm worried about is just our love for the lost. That we are continually wanting to reach the world outside of us with the gospel, whether that's international or local. I probably think about that more than anything else. And I still feel as a burden, as a pastor, the burden of wanting to make sure that we are leaning into that issue and thinking carefully about it. Because Paul, at least at the pastoral level, tells Timothy, do the work of an evangelist. Among all the things, preach the word in season, out of season, and do the work of an evangelist. And so I take that to heart. Like, what do I need to do? I mean, he doesn't spell it out. That's the hard part. What does that mean? I don't necessarily think it means a single methodology, which is the danger that some people have gotten into. When I was in seminary, there was a fad by a particular missionary who had wild success with a particular methodology on the mission field. And he came back and he was convinced that we all needed to learn this methodology. This was the way. And I'll just let you know, it was chronological Bible storying. 40 weeks of starting in the book of Genesis and going all the way through, and you don't even get to the gospel until like week 32. So you had to go and you had to start these Bible studies and you had to kind of take people through these stories. And it was through stories that people were going to hear the gospel. And his premise was America is a post-Christian nation. He had ministered in a non-Christian nation and an unreached people group. And if we were going to reach our unreached people group, this is what we need to do. And I just thought, this is far-fetched. Because I had just come from China, which was a truly non-Christian nation. And as unchristian as we are becoming, we're still a long way from where China is. So I was not buying it. Not to mention the fact that I couldn't imagine waiting 32 weeks to tell someone the gospel if they're asking me questions about the gospel. He was actually saying, if they're asking questions, hold off until week 32. You don't want to spoil it. I was like, I wish Peter would have known that when he's talking to the Ethiopian guy. I think there's people that just get so focused on a particular methodology, like this is the end all. And every time I go into the waters of baptism to hear people's testimony, what I hear is a diversity of ways that people have come to know the gospel. I mean, some people heard from their parents. Some people heard from a friend at school or a counseling session or, you know, whatever. They went on a mission trip sometimes and came to know Christ that way. So while I have a burden that we do evangelism, I can't always say that I'm crystal clear on what that means, you know, in terms of what programs we might do or something. But it's a burden of mine. I'm always inquisitive to want to know how could we do better at that. So that's kind of where my heart is. It's not saying that's where every elder's heart is, because I think God made us all different. It's just me. You know, it's just kind of what I think about, what I pray about. My wife and I pray about this together in the evenings for our church, that we wouldn't lose our first love and that we would love the lost. Yes, Jonathan.
Speaking of methodology and where is, are there plans to do any kind of doing a Sunday school class or even in this setting on hermeneutics or biblical interpretation?
Well, we used to have something called Faith Training Institute, and it covered a 8-class program that covered basic hermeneutics, systematic theology, you know, things like that. I think we even had one class on, you know, basics of biblical Greek or something like that. So we have been talking about reviving that when we get into our building. I don't think we would do it on Sunday morning, primarily because we lack space. I mean, we can only have in the new building one adult Sunday school class per hour. And we wouldn't want to set that aside to do some class like that. So we'll probably do it at another time if we do it. But we are thinking about that because we're always thinking about developing new leaders and what is necessary to develop those new leaders. And we recognize that some men will want to go to formal training like seminary, but for some men that's not in the cards for them. Their business or their work just is not going to allow them to be at school, you know, 2 days a week or something. So we want to do something that can develop lay leaders as well as what you might call vocational leaders as well. But I can't tell you anything specific beyond that. We certainly see there's an ongoing need to offer that kind of training within the church. So, other questions? All right. Well, we can close and go home. Yes.
Pastor Shane, how and when would you offer unsolicited parenting advice? I think about it every Sunday.
Yeah. I offer unsolicited advice to Richard so he can offer it to whoever's. Well, I am, I guess I would begin by saying, yes, I'm very, I would be hesitant. Or I would say, it maybe a different way, I have seen some people who are too eager. That's probably about the right way to say that. There are people who are too eager to do that. And many times, the ones who are most eager are the ones who have the least experience. So those who have young children who have figured out parenting with their six-year-old should probably dial it back a little bit. Those who have raised children and, you know, and maybe have you know, seen their kids leave the home and have a little life perspective really ought to be the ones who are being a bit more assertive in coming alongside of other families and even young parents. But the most damaging or the most hurtful things have come from, you know, some mom who has an 8-year-old, and the 8-year-old checks all the boxes, does all the homework, usually a firstborn. You know, they're very proud of their little kid, and then they take it upon themselves to start lecturing other people that, you know, they see the kids maybe not doing the right thing. And I think that's not, it's not taking a proper due perspective on what you don't know, or a recognition that there are unique circumstances that are going on in other people's homes that you at least need to take some time to investigate and find out before you speak into some of those issues. So there's a longevity that I think needs to be there or needs to be established before you do that kind of unsolicited input. The longevity might come from your own parenting, or it could come from a longevity of relationship with that person. Like you have known them and watched them and observed them, and they've been in the church long enough where you start to think, okay, yeah, I think I understand the dynamics that are going on in their home, or whatever it might be. So my first thing would be a caution for people not to speak too quickly where you don't know. But then for those who do have some seasoning, this is what the Bible wants us to do. Older men teaching younger men. Older women teaching younger women. And Paul's explicit about that. He says that the older women ought to teach the younger women how to love their husbands and how to love their children and how to be makers at home. That's what they're supposed to be teaching them. And I would assume that would include parenting. So sometimes, you know, when you have some seasoning, you ought to be taking advantage of some of that. The seasoning, however, is the very thing that gives you some checks to some of the rash decisions you would make, because you see now you have perspective to see the naivete that you might have had, or the rashness, or even sometimes the, you know, the mistakes that you made. But that's all that stuff's very healthy, and that stuff's very good. So I don't know if that answers your question, but that's where I am. So I'm probably more assertive now than I used to be, and probably getting more assertive every day. Some of it's just old man disease. You don't really care what people think of you anymore. You just say what you want. That's old man disease. I know. I'm too young to be playing that card.
I would offer, be cautious with the youngsters. Susie and I came from First Baptist, and one of the first things we encountered at Faith Community was the little ankle priors and kneecappers, and we love them. We just think they add such an effervescence to the church because we see them. You don't see those in big churches because they close them off and the security issues, I understand that. But what a treat to see those kids having a good time with each other, growing up with each other, loving on each other. You know, you might get run over by a single wheel, jump out of the way, you know, or caution the child. You need to be careful. Please be a little more careful with folks. Or what? Don't go with a snipe, I think, if you're doing that in a gentle way.
Well, I hope our church is filled with people with that attitude from particular your generation. I have seen churches with older generations that are very self-centered. The older people are just, you know, they want the whole church to orient around them. But I love that our church is filled with senior saints who love young people. And they love to see families. And I think you're exactly right. The church loses something whenever they sort of cordon off those young people and you don't see all those dynamics. Part of it is you don't get to see how the parents are dealing with their kids. And so you can't really step in there sometimes. So I hope that our older folks are constantly fostering that kind of love for young families and love for the church. But be aware that we are aware as elders about the ankle biters, and we talk about it with some level of regularity.
Fortunately, we were never there.
But
we went through that phase and never had a problem.
You just never had, your kids always obeyed. Yes, I know. They probably came in like ducklets, you know, following you behind. Now, we're aware of how older folks sometimes are a little unstable. They get more nervous with people racing around them. Not to mention that we have dangerous equipment and electricity and all that stuff. And so unsupervised kids, unfortunately, is a common topic for us at our leadership meetings. And we try to strike the balance of not being overbearing. But also protecting and guarding the people who are gathering on Sunday morning. So it's not always easy, you know, thinking that through. I don't know, Richard, do you want to give some perspective on that?
No, don't do that.
Okay. Any other questions? Yes, Jeff.
Unsolicited advice or whatever. How do we think through when people in our church just disappear? Whether they announce it or not, or you hear third hand from somebody that they've moved on, and the best you can tell, they didn't really seek counsel. So how do we think about that? Do we reach out? How do you do that?
Well, we do when we are aware of it. It is a challenge in... in first of all, our society, we're in a metropolitan area. It's not small town. So in a small town, you might always bump into the person at Kroger and be a little bit more familiar with people's comings and goings. And then, it's a natural consequence of a church that, you know, gets to a medium size like ours, where it's a little more difficult to kind of keep track of people. But we try to address it, first of all, proactively with our membership process. We try to, in the membership process, put the language in there of our expectations of them as members, that they don't just disappear. We even have a little thing in our membership material about leaving a church. When's a good reason to leave a church? And when we don't think it's a good reason to leave a church. Certainly, there are people who leave under the worst of circumstances. That is to say that they are publicly disciplined from the church. There are other people who leave for good reasons. They're going, getting married, or they're going to take a job in a different place. But then there are all those people in between who are leaving because they've been disgruntled with some relationship, maybe with a church leader, maybe with just a church member. And those we don't think are good reasons to leave churches. We think those are reasons to go back and be reconciled with your brother or sister. And when you don't do that, you are short-circuiting the sanctification process in your own life. So as an elder, that's our primary concern. It's not that they are leaving, you know, sort of our church. It's the fact that we want to see Christ formed in them. And we know that they're running away from a problem. And if they're running away from this problem, they'll probably run away from the next problem and the next problem and the next problem. So out of a desire to see Christ formed in them, we want to see them resolve relationships in a positive way. And that's what church commitment or membership commitment is designed to do, is to force you into this, as some people call it, a covenant with one another. It's force you into this level of commitment that you're going to work through issues, but people don't. And I think it's out of a sense of embarrassment or shame or not wanting accountability that they don't notify you when they leave. Because there's a sense that they know that they're not doing what's right. And it makes them very hesitant to speak with you. So we hate to see that. And there's another complication with two services. Because you're not even in the same service. You know, you sometimes find yourself like, well, maybe they're going to a different service. You know, maybe they haven't actually left the church. So it takes a little while for us to hear about those kinds of things. And unfortunately, by the time we do realize what's going on, I mean, it can be months before we actually be able to address them, and they're somewhat entrenched in a new direction. So the recovery rate of that is not great. I wish I knew the secret sauce to solve that problem, other than just trying to say we're just proactive about stating up front what we, you know, what we want. When we do find out about it, we reach out. We normally try to schedule a face-to-face meeting. We try to hear and understand what was going through their mind, and we try to challenge them to the best that we can. Every situation is different. Some of those you feel like you need to be much more firm in the challenge. Some of them you just realize, you know, that this person is made up their mind. You know, they're not coming back. And so you think about ways that you can best help them transition to a healthy church, a good church, because they're not coming back. And I think it's just tactful and wise to realize that you can beat your head against the wall, or you can just try to be God's grace in their life to make sure that they get to a good place. And so sometimes I find myself in those situations talking to them about how God's not pleased with the relationships that they left. Sometimes I find myself in those situations just asking them, well, what are you looking for in a new church? You know, what is it that's guiding and making that determination? So depending on the situation, that will determine how I deal with it whenever I talk to them. Or one of our other elders, you know, because we're all involved with that process. Even with all those efforts, though, you know, I don't know what percentage is. I mean, there's always a couple people that just leave and just we never hear from them. Even though we reach out to them, we just never hear from them. This is happening recently to me. Somebody left. I wrote 3 emails to them. Tried to schedule a time to get together. We had something, and they canceled it, and then they haven't answered any email since then. So, you know, what can you do at that point? At some point, you just realize, you know, they're just not going to talk to me. And just Godspeed to them. Hopefully the Lord will be gracious to them. So
I'll just add one thing, is that this is my conviction anyway, I don't think it's necessarily up to the elders to be doing that all the time either.
Babysitters.
Well, because oftentimes, I can recall several occasions where we know the situation like this, but we also know there's one or two or three faithful people in our church who are engaged, and so it's not incumbent upon us to come in and, you know, with some official capacity, as long as the faithful members of the church are.
Yeah, that's a very good word. I mean, I think that's sometimes something that we're always trying to build up is this mentality that we're equipping people to do the work of the ministry, and that's part of the work of the ministry as well. And I still think people struggle to know that. So I talked to someone this week that I reached out to because something was going on in their life, and the person said to me, "Well, it's great to hear from you. I mean, you're the first elder that I've heard from." I was like, oh, okay. So you haven't heard from anybody? Oh, no. I've got several phone calls. And I was like, well, that's great. I mean, that's what the church is supposed to do. So I'm glad I could call you. I'm a brother in Christ. But don't feel like you have to hear from one of the guys at the top. I mean, the church is ministering to you. And that's something you're always having to pour into, the church. Other questions? Or yes.
Obviously, a modern contemporary writer said, under God, all things are without exception, despite all appearances to the contrary, fully under control.
Hold on, I got to unpack that. Okay, yeah, I think I followed. I'm just joking with you, John. That was a lot of big words thrown together. Yes, you're right. God is sovereign, and his providence is at work. And that's through the church and through all those people's circumstances. It's part of what drives you as an elder. I don't have a lot of sleepless nights because I realize very, very well my limitations of my own self. And, I'm not going to be able to do everything. So I just focus on what I can do that day and leave the rest in the hands of the Lord. Charlie?
Yeah, can you talk about the positives and negatives of using confessions, like the Westminster Confession, too? I was on a church website, and that was their main doctrinal statement, just the Westminster Confession.
Well, I think they're positive in the sense that they're historical, and they give you a good sense of the historical church. But they are a byproduct of a state church. They came out of what was Catholic, the Catholic magisterium, and the Catholic catechism set the mold for what then became the Reformed confessions. That was what you did back in those days. You had a state-level church, and the state-level church stated the acceptable doctrine, and then everyone who was in the state accepted that doctrine if they were part of the state church. And I think as we have moved away from a state church into local autonomy that we believe in Baptist churches, that those kinds of statements are really not the defining thing for us. We need to go back to the scripture and define for ourselves what our doctrinal statement is. So we don't necessarily feel any obligation or commitment to subscribe to any of those. And honestly, I don't know any confessional statement that we would subscribe to, that 100% we would subscribe to. So since we can't subscribe to everything in the doctrinal statement, whether it's the London Baptist 1689 or the Westminster or whatever, since we can't subscribe to all of that, then why not just go and put into print what we believe? Even the Baptist Faith and Message, which is a denominational statement, is so vague I suppose anyone could subscribe to it, but we felt like it was so weak it wasn't helpful to just say that was our statement of faith. So we felt like there was a need to articulate our particular doctrine. Now, with all that said, that's kind of our Baptistic heritage and Baptistic tendencies, to want to be local church, autonomous, not sort of dictated to by a denomination, but really accepting our responsibility for guarding and protecting and somewhat defining the church. We celebrate the heritage that those things represent. Like we're not anti Westminster, because we recognize that was a product of a lot of godly men searching through a lot of things at that particular period of time. There was a lot of things that they articulated. And so sometimes I'll quote the Westminster Confession in a sermon in a positive way, because we recognize that they are snapshots into doctrinal development at that particular historical time. I do think that there is now in our country a drive back to liturgy pressing people to want to embrace these confessions again, going all the way back to even the Nicene Creed. And people feel like they need to recite these as a part of a liturgy in the church. They either read the Nicene Creed, or they'll read from a particular confessional on Sunday morning as a way of educating their people doctrinally. But I think that is part of a larger movement that is fallacious. The larger movement towards liturgy, the liturgy that people are striving for, is born out of, I believe, a hunger for depth and a hunger for wanting to connect to something richer, more meaningful than what they have experienced in church. but they're looking in the wrong place. They're looking for liturgy and for catechisms or confessionals to connect with some rich heritage because they've experienced superficial, shallow preaching and they want something deeper. Well, what they need is deep preaching, not confessionals and stuff like that. So I'm sympathetic to what's going on. I mean, it started years ago with people wanting to light candles and bring images into the worship services. You saw that in a number of different places. I mean, people were really big about bringing back images and pictures and paintings. I mean, this is stuff of the Catholic Church. And then they wanted to bring the scents and the smells. And then they're wanting to bring the catechisms. They're going back to some level of what they consider to be mysticism. And that's really what it is. There's a mysticism for them that is tied up with these old rituals and old ceremonies that makes them feel like they're connecting to something deep and rich. But they're just hungering for something because they had some, you know, shallow preacher screaming at them for 20 years, and they finally wanted to separate from that, but what they're going to is really not going to serve them any better. What they need is preaching from the Bible. And what I have found is when you're in churches that do that on a consistent basis, people aren't clamoring for confessionals and catechisms. They're not clamoring for that stuff. They're so enamored with what the Bible says that that there's never any discussion of incorporating those things. So that's kind of, I know there's two parts, two answers to that question. One of them is why we don't do it from a philosophical standpoint, but one of them is sort of cultural dynamic of why I think people are doing it and why it really doesn't make sense for us to do it. Yes, Chris?
There are two things that I think they can serve. One is as a reference point. If you want to know what Reformed theology is, Westminster Confession of Faith is your document. That is the summary that everyone refers back to. So if you're like, you know, what does this person believe or that person believe, or what is Reformed faith, they all refer to that. The other thing is catechisms can be great, concise, clear definitions because they're written for the church. And so sometimes I'll be looking at something and looking for a definition, a clear definition, and you look in that confession and you think, wow, they really nailed it. They really got it down to the essence and clear language. So.
Yeah, that's good input. I mean, I was thinking primarily about their use on a Sunday morning, but I think Chris is helpful there to kind of say, you know, if you expand beyond the Sunday morning worship service, they do have their purposes for sure.
So you see a good catechizing our children training?
I don't think that personally. I mean, I don't think that catechism, you know, having your kids recite catechism answers is the best way. If you're doing what Deuteronomy 6 talks about, which is talking to your kids about the Bible all the time. When you go, when you rise up, when you sit down, when you go out, when you come in, that's what we did. I mean, when we were, you know, you could have inserted minivan into the verse. You know, when you load the minivan, when you unload the minivan, that's what we did. We were always talking to our kids about the Bible in the context of whatever they're going through, and I think it's more meaningful, impactful for them if they're hearing the Bible applied to that particular situation rather than just sort of some cold recitation of certain doctrines. I suppose it can't hurt to do that, but don't imagine that that's supposed to replace Deuteronomy 6 in some fashion, because I think Deuteronomy 6 implies in the flow of life. You're talking to your kids in the flow of life about life situations and life issues. Yes, John.
I'm assuming that you, when you're preparing for your Sunday morning messages, that you look at commentary. What would be like your number one sources of commentary?
Well, it's different for every book. Not everyone is an expert on everything. So, you know, depending on which book you ask me, I would tell you which commentaries I think are best in that particular arena. But I do think when I recommend for people to get started with a library, I often tell them that the Expositor's Bible Commentary, which is a set of commentaries on the whole Bible, is, I think, a really good, accessible, and relatively faithful all-in-one set. There are stronger editions and weaker editions in even that, but in terms of consistency, it's one of the more consistently good and helpful and as I said, accessible commentary series. You know, I obviously wouldn't be surprising to hear that for the New Testament, I really like John MacArthur's set. It's basically Bible exposition put into readable format with some level of detail. I think for a layperson wanting to just understand the Bible better, that's a really good resource to go to. But apart from that, you know, it's going to be kind of book by book. There are a couple of faithful guys that anytime they wrote on something, I always say this about a guy named D. Edmund Hebert. He didn't write much, but when he wrote, you need to get that commentary. So, you know, he's got something on the pastorals. He's got something on the Johannine works, Mark. So there's D.A. Carson's another person like that. You know, typically, if you can find something written by D.A. Carson, you're reading really good stuff. I don't know. It's kind of a question that could take up a long time if I went book by book walking all the way through. For Matthew, I think for D.A. Carson's work in Expositor's Bible is one of the better ones. R.T. France is one of the guys that I find most consistently helpful, although, you know, we certainly have our theological disagreements at points. Michael Wilkins wrote a commentary which is, I think, really good, and David Baker. It's the Baker Exegetical Commentary. Am I thinking right, David Baker? I think it is. Anyway, Baker Exegetical Commentary by David somebody. I think it's David Baker. Those have probably been the most consistently helpful. In addition to that, I mean, I read about 10 commentaries per week. So I have others that I use that are less consistently helpful, but I still try to read broadly when I'm reading through a book.
I've read France some in the past.
Yeah. France is, you know, eschatologically very different. He is preterist. So when you're in something like Matthew 24, he's helpful because he's you know, helping you understand how the preterists are arguing for a passage like that, which is, For me, you know, I'm preparing a message for a pulpit, I feel like is the level of preparation that I need to be doing anyway. I wouldn't necessarily say that every person should read 10 commentaries for every passage because most people don't have that kind of time. I try to read broadly so that I understand the arguments from all sides on all these different passages.
David Turner,
yes. I knew Baker didn't sound right. David Turner in the Baker Exegetical Commentary. Other questions? Yes, Caleb.
I was talking to someone at a picnic, and they were saying how thankful they were to be at our church because we're so family integrated. I had that first of like, I don't think we're family integrated, but I asked them what they meant, and they just meant that we bring our kids in the church. we don't have like a kid separate church. So could you define, like when you hear family integrated, like what do you understand that as, and how, where's faith community on that?
Well, there is, I can't remember the name of the group. They're based in Raleigh. I think they're called like the Family Integrated Institute or something like that, that has set out to try to promote this issue recently of what they consider to be family integrated churches. But by which they mean that the church is built around family units in everything. And so they don't really have separate Sunday school classes for anybody of any age. They do everything family. They do family Sunday school, family church. They even promote the serving of communion by the heads of the households, which to me would be just a chaotic kind of a thing. I always wonder what that must seem or feel like as a single mom coming to a church like that. Like, they're the dads are serving communion to their family. So what does a single mom do? Does she take communion from the dad of another family? What is the world? How does the world look at something like that? Does that man now have two wives? My mind starts to go all these different directions when I read this kind of literature. So I think we're a long way from what the Family Integrated Institute defines as family integrated. But we're definitely not as segmented and segregated as the more modern congregations who try to keep kids at bay, you know, until adolescence. So that is certainly something that's there. We do it because we feel like the kids need to be acclimated to the worship service at an early age. Or let me say it this way. They have to be acclimated at some point, and learning that from an early age, we believe to be a better process, a better way of going. So, I don't ever put that in the context of being family integrated, because there's no philosophical thing that's driving us the way that family integrated churches philosophically exalt the family unit. I think, to an improper place within the church. We value families, but we're not exalting the family unit to the quasi-elder status that family-integrated churches do. We're just encouraging what we think are the, I guess you might say, the multi-generational ministry that you see reflected in Scripture. So, yeah, that's the way I would put it. Yeah. I don't know, Richard, do you have anything to add to that? I don't know if there's any. Brian's not here, right? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, in the vault, I know that we cover a few sessions on oral apologetics, and then you shift it over to, I think, Christian nationalism, mm-hmm. a few sessions on that. Any thoughts about doing something more formal around apologetics at Faith Community Church?
I don't think we'd be opposed to it. It would probably come into something. It would probably come as a part of something like our Faith Training Institute, or maybe some sort of symposium seminar. But I think that there are our apologetics are actually woven into a lot of other things that we do. They're woven into even the preaching. I feel like I'm always teaching hermeneutics when I'm preaching, and I also feel like I'm always teaching apologetics. They're woven into our parenting material. They're woven into our counseling training. We're constantly talking about what our approach to apologetics is presuppositional. So we're weaving presuppositionalism into all of those things. So I don't feel like there's a sort of a I guess you might say, stirring within us like there's some huge deficiency in equipping people to do that. But, I mean, I think there's certainly a value to kind of even step back broader and go deeper into what presuppositional apologetics is versus evidentialism. And so, yeah, that might be something that we institute later on. Yes?
Is there a place in the church to remind members of the national heritage, the national Christian heritage of the country? And the reason I think about that is because of the Christian nationalism. I'm a funny reader. Somebody selling books. Because we will not become a Christian nation, but we could become a more moral nation. And the Christian faith could be impetus. Can't talk to people about where we came from for them to understand it and to defend that position.
Well, I think, you know, we, you know, first of all, you know, historically, churches, if you just go outside of America, historically, churches did not integrate with nationalism, at least, you know, in their written documents and things like that. This was not part of the worship service. There was no sort of celebration of God and of nation that you would see in the historic churches. There was a focus on just worshiping the glory of God. And so we're much more eager to connect with not only our biblical roots and foundations. You don't see any call from the Apostle Paul to do that kind of thing in the New Testament. You don't see any part of that in the historic church. So for us, some people would describe us as primitivist. That's a term, theological term, to talk about people who are just trying to always go back to the pure Bible. Like, what do we see in the Bible? That's what we want to reflect. And so since we don't see a necessarily a call to celebrate your nationalism, we're not super eager to incorporate that into our worship service. However, I mean, we want to think about the due gratitude that we ought to have towards the Lord for the freedoms that we have, the people who have sacrificed and given their lives for us, and those kinds of things. So if you see it reflected in us, it would probably come across that way, not a celebration of a Christian foundation, because that's very muddled, you know, that, as you well know. I mean, there were some more pronounced Christians in our founding fathers, and then there's some who were definitely not. So, you know, that's a muddled and even debated history, and we don't want to necessarily bring that debate into the church. There is probably a little personal for me, a little fear of confusion that is always lurking out there, of not wanting to go back to the days of the moral majority, which I kind of knew as a young man growing up in the church, that there was always this political action element that was being inserted into the church. Like, we were, I wasn't always sure if we were at a worship service or a political rally, you know, and that just, as a young Christian, experiencing that in the church did not leave a good taste in my mouth. And so I might confess to a little bit of overreaction sometimes to that, not wanting our church to ever be co-opted for some political party or political candidate, and wanting to guard it for the glory of God. But in doing that, I might, you know, I may not always be as sensitive to just expressing the gratitude that we do genuinely feel. I mean, when I hear the stories of veterans and what they've been through and what they've gone through, I watch these old documentaries of D-Day invasion, I'm always sort of overwhelmed by what I did not have to. I mean, I sit there and watch and think, I don't know that I couldn't have been on that landing boat. I'm not sure if I could have done that, you know. Yeah, well, I'm super grateful for the men who paid those prices, and I would encourage anybody to express that gratitude. But there are some core principles that drive what we do on Sunday morning in the worship service that are going to always sort of push back against bringing some of that stuff into, you know, sort of a formal presentation in the worship service. My first church I pastored was literally next to an army base. We had so many veterans in the church, and the very first month that I was there was Memorial Day. It was Memorial Day weekend, and they had the full color guard marching down the aisle, you know, in the middle of the service. I mean, it was like big time. You know, celebrate all the armed services. We played the anthems of the armed services in the worship service. So definitely we won't be doing that necessarily. But they celebrated everything. You know, Independence Day, Memorial Day, Veterans Day. It was all on the church calendar.
One last question. Is there any way to apply the Reformed Church
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, pride is probably a modern word that I wouldn't use. Thankfulness, yes. There's plenty of room for thankfulness for your heritage. To say, I'm so thankful that my parents gave me what they gave me. That they left me this example to follow. Or that my nation provided for me what they provided for me. I'm thankful for that. But I would just not advise the word pride, even though I know there's a sort of a wholesome use of that word. I still don't think it's probably ringing right true with what this Bible really calls us to. All right, guys, thanks for your time the whole year.